Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, how to get in. Welcome to the 174th episode of Admission Straight Talk, the podcast dedicated to graduate admissions and helping you approach the application process thoughtfully and successfully. I'm Linda Abraham, the founder of Accepted and the host of this podcast. My mission and passion is to help you get to that delightful instant when you can high-five the person next to you and shout, "Yes, I'm in!" And not only in, but in at the best program for you. Johns Hopkins Medical School is ranked number 3 by U.S. News for Research and number 17 for primary care. Last year, it received 6,090 MCAS applications, 4,327 secondary applications, and interviewed 623 MD candidates and 63 MD PhD applicants. It accepted a total of 271 very lucky and happy applicants. The gatekeeper and head of admissions at Johns Hopkins is Paul White, one of the most respected and experienced medical school admissions deans in the country. He became assistant dean for admissions at Johns Hopkins first in 2000, went to the University of Minnesota for a few years, and returned to Johns Hopkins as assistant dean for admissions in 2012. Paul, thanks for joining me today on Admission Straight Talk.
Well, it's my pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
I'm delighted to speak with you. Now, I think that the first thing I'd like is just, if for listeners who may not be familiar with the Johns Hopkins Medical, what would be the first thing you would want applicants and potential future physicians to know about your medical school?
Well, you know, Linda, we're often thought of in terms of the amazing research that is done at Hopkins, but this is also a hospital that treats patients, and we want our School of Medicine students to learn how to actually work with patients. So we're a phenomenal place to learn how to actually do patient care and not just research.
Great. Okay. Can you give an overview of the Johns Hopkins approach to physician training?
Well, it integrates all aspects of the education. I mean, the students come here for their orientation, which lasts 2 days, and the very next day, they learn how to do physical exams and interview patients. They, of course, have anatomy for several weeks, but they also have a longitudinal clerkship and actually get out into the community to work with physicians.
So they have clinical exposure really from day two?
I'll say day three.
Okay, fair enough.
Right, day three. Absolutely, absolutely. That's a critical part of the education here. But even the clinical rotations, they occur much earlier than most institutions. Of course, we have 2 years in terms of our scientific foundations for medicine, but the second year is somewhat truncated because you have a month-long course called Transition to Wards in February and into March, and then they actually go into their clinical rotations soon after that.
So they have actually almost 2.5 years of clinical rotations.
That's exactly right.
In addition to the early exposure.
That's right, in addition to the early exposure. And what's wonderful about Hopkins is that we have world-class hospitals here.
Mm-hmm.
And while people come here for certainly primary care and secondary care, they come from all over the world for tertiary care. You really do get to see how medicine is done up close and personal.
Right. I think I actually have a daughter who doesn't live in Baltimore, but she lives elsewhere in Maryland, and I think she's part of the Johns Hopkins healthcare system now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But she obviously chose it because she knows it's outstanding. Mm-hmm. Now, let's talk, well, actually, before we talk admissions, I know I was reading on the website and preparing for the call today about the Genes to Society curriculum and the approach to medical education that has been pioneered by Johns Hopkins. And I think you alluded to it in your response a minute ago, but can you go into a little bit more depth about what that means?
Well, you know, unfortunately, I'm not a physician, so
right.
I probably can't go into as much depth as some of my colleagues. But I will say that Hopkins wants Genes to Society, wants the students to approach Genes to Society as a continuum, as we say on our website. And so you're looking at all aspects of the patient from when they are the you know, the body is normal.
Genetic.
Pre-disease to disease, yeah.
Right.
And also, our students are looking at health disparities as part of that continuum.
Mm-hmm. So that would be the society part. Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's right, exactly.
Mm-hmm. So it's the molecular, the genetic, the system, the society.
And also social.
Right. Right. Okay. And in terms of the social, are there classes on the interplay between culture and medicine or societal influence, social influences and compliance, those kinds of things? Or is it more an experiential kind of learning?
I would say both. There are intersections between years one and two, or in years one and two, excuse me, and one and it concerns healthcare disparities mm-hmm. and advocacy. Another is called prevention and health promotion.
Uh-huh.
So yeah, that's why I say it's definitely a part of it. We also have an intercession on substance abuse.
Uh-huh. So definitely, right. Okay. Let's turn to medical school admissions, which obviously is your forte. The new MCAT. Yeah, okay. Let's get comfortable now, right? The new MCAT is now a little over a year old. And I know you're dealing sometimes with applicants applying with old MCAT, the new MCAT, and sometimes both.
Sometimes both, that's right.
Right. How are you adapting to this kind of transition phase? Are you relying more on grades when students submit the new MCAT? Do you feel the new test is an improvement? Are you comfortable with it? I mean, how's that working out?
Well, let's start with the question of comfort.
Okay.
We're not there yet.
Okay.
I think it's going to take a little more time, and not just Hopkins. I think for most medical schools, it's going to, this is it's still very much in transition, let's put it that way, and that comfort will, I think, come as we become more accustomed to seeing the new MCAT. But right now, schools like Hopkins are still seeing both.
Right.
But what's interesting is we probably have relied a little more on not just grades, but also looking very closely at the coursework the student has taken.
Sure.
And looking at the recommendation letters. And you know, we do admissions holistically anyway, so it never was just about the MCAT. I'm seeing a lot of students scoring in the 95th, 96th to 100th percentile on the new MCAT. That was not the case with the old MCAT.
Hmm.
And that's caught us all off guard a little, and we're a little surprised by that, but at the same time, we still haven't lost sight of the fact that we look at the student's profile and what type of courses they're taking, how demanding those courses are, and how well they perform in them.
One of the things that struck me when I was, again, preparing for the call today is I checked on the MSAR, and it mm-hmm. showed that Johns Hopkins median MCAT on the old scale for matriculants was a 36, but for applicants it was a 37. In the middle 80% mm-hmm. range was
it for applicants or for admits?
No, it said, if I read it correctly, it was matriculants was 36 and applicants was 37, which would mm-hmm. imply that you frequently were accepting people with lower scores than you necessarily had to.
That's right. Well, there is something to that. I mean, there are people who would apply with scores in the 40s who didn't get an interview.
Right. And the middle 80% range was 33 to 40. The overall GPA was 3.8 to 4.0, which is pretty impressive.
Yeah, and our average was 3.91 actually for matriculant.
Okay, so there you go. What would cause you to turn away people with higher MCAT scores in favor of those with lower MCAT scores?
Well, of course, there's no one answer, but I think mm-hmm. an answer is that if that's all they had with a high MCAT
right.
score, then that doesn't really inform the committee anything other than that the person tested well.
Mm-hmm.
When I say we look holistically, I absolutely mean that we were doing holistic reviews before the term became fashionable.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're interested in students who may be from different backgrounds, but everyone talks about how remarkable they are, in not only in terms of their classroom work, but outside the classroom, the leadership they display, and their interest in patients and understanding of medicine informs their applications. And if their only attribute is having an exceptional MCAT score, I mean, they're not rejected out of hand, but those people are certainly not going to be our first choice to go to for an interview. We'd rather see someone who may have a lower MCAT score, and that's all relative, of course, when you say lower, but they've done it very, very well overall, and they have all the other qualities that we feel make a competitive candidate for admission and an outstanding medical student.
You mentioned leadership as one of the qualities that you're looking for. What are some of the other qualities you're looking for?
Oh, I would say in addition to leadership, we look for people who can also be a team player.
Mm-hmm.
And work well with others. We look for those who have a strong service orientation.
Right.
They're going into medicine for all the right reasons and not just for personal glory. And we look for people who also understand the science of medicine.
Do students or should applicants to Hopkins have both clinical and research experience in their background?
Well, surprisingly, neither is required, unless, okay, of course, you're doing an MD, PhD.
Right.
But it certainly helps to have both in their background, because at the end of the day, how do you know that being a physician is right for you if you've never been exposed to patients,
right,
in some way? And in terms of research, we find that students with research backgrounds, with some research in their backgrounds, let's put it that way, often have a better understanding of the science of medicine and why it's important to know physics and why it's important to know biochemistry and how it relates to medicine.
In terms of the clinical exposure, is there... And you say exposure to patients. Mm-hmm. Now, I've heard from some people that, you know, experience like EMT work, being a scribe, a medic in the military, they're actually working with patients. That's very hands-on. That's probably, you know, the gold standard in terms of clinical exposure.
I would agree.
Okay, what about shadowing?
I think shadowing is a wonderful way of introducing medicine to your understanding of what it takes, but if it ends there, I don't think that provides them with any advantage in our process. We really like for people to have more in-depth knowledge, mm-hmm, of the physician-patient relationship, the role that the physician plays on a team, the role that the physician with the patient and their family, even.
Right.
And you may get some of that from shadowing, but if you're actually up close and doing hands-on care, I think, you know, and that's not going to come right away. I mean, that's why I say shadowing may be a good start. But most of the people I think who are truly competitive have taken it up a notch or two or three in some cases, by gaining in their experience and in many cases becoming certified either as an EMT or paramedic or phlebotomist or getting training as a scribe or doing clinical research at a major research institution.
Right. Well, that makes complete and total sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
And one of our staff also pointed out that when you do shadow, not that it still has value, but
oh, it definitely has value.
Yeah, mm-hmm. But it's also very passive.
Your staff could have been listening to me because I say that all the time.
Right.
That shadowing is passive, and we want them to be active at some point.
Right.
There's no question.
And the other point she makes, this is Alicia McNeese-Namonkar that I'm quoting, is that in addition to being passive, the only one that benefits from the shadowing is the shadower, the applicant. The patient doesn't benefit, the doctor doesn't benefit. But if you are an EMT or a phlebotomist or a scribe, then you are actually participating in the medical process and hopefully participating in the healing and curing or assisting of somebody who's sick, injured, or unwell for whatever reason.
That's absolutely correct. And that's also why we like to see service, because when you're serving others, you're not being passive.
Right. Sure.
When you're being a leader, you're not being passive, presumably.
Correct.
When you're doing research, you're not being passive. I think to succeed, you have to demonstrate some level of action.
Initiative.
Initiative, exactly.
Yeah. Okay, that's great. Thank you. Now, I'm interviewing you today, mid-September, and this podcast will go live at the beginning of October. Many med school applicants are currently choking, drowning in secondaries, choking on and drowning in secondaries, at least the lucky ones. Now, what's your general advice to applicants for handling and responding to secondaries?
Well, first of all, I think secondaries aren't nearly as time-consuming as applicants may think. You don't have to invent the wheel for every secondary. There's some information that we all look for on our secondary applications, much of it duplicative in terms of what they had on the AMCAS application or the primary application. But it is worth mentioning that they have to take the time, look at the questions, and make sure that they are, in fact, answering the question of the particular institution that has sent them the secondary.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes sense to look at those as soon as possible. Not necessarily, you know, turn them around right away, but certainly turn them around within a respectful amount of time. But they have to review the secondary before they submit it. I will tell you, I just read a secondary today, and the person made two huge glaring mistakes on their secondary. And I'm sure that he will die when he looks at it later on.
Wrong name? Wrong school name?
Well, that's just a glaring error. I mean, he actually duplicated his answers in a couple places.
Oh, really?
Word for word.
I see what you mean.
And I kept going back and forth. I thought, well, you know, which one is it?
Yeah.
And then I realized I don't have the time to do that.
No, of course not. Of course not. The secondary.
That's a glaring mistake.
Yeah.
I think that easily have been rectified by careful review before hitting submit.
Absolutely. Now, I think the biggest difference between the primary and the secondary is that the secondaries are very much about showing fit within a specific medical school, medical program. So you can
Absolutely.
Always adapt the essays, but even if the question is basically the same, the response shouldn't be the same because the school is different. Would you agree with that?
I do agree with that. I mean, part of what we look for when screening applicants to interview is how well do they answer our very short answer question. We want to learn a little about their value and what they consider important, because, frankly, by asking the questions we ask, they should get a sense of our values.
Right.
And so what we'd like to see is how well do they meet those.
Right. And you had mentioned a minute ago, what is that they should turn them around in a respectable amount of time. What is a respectable amount of time in your view?
Well, we don't put a timeline
right.
Other than get them in by the deadline. I will say that.
Right.
And we really do read applications from mid-August or early August through February.
Okay.
And if they want to get an interview sooner rather than later, then we need to get the secondary in, because, frankly, just hitting submit doesn't mean you'll get a notice of completion. It takes 2-3 weeks,
mm-hmm.
2 or 3 weeks, in some cases a little longer, the more applications, the further we get into the application season. And some people start to panic because they think, well, I haven't heard anything.
Right.
We're still processing. So that's why I think if they can get it in within a week, that doesn't mean they're going to hear from us within a week, but they certainly, if they wait and, you know, a month to send it in or 6 weeks to send it in, then that means it's really 8 to 10 weeks before right. they hear anything.
Right. Yeah. I get the calls. I submitted it on this date and I haven't heard. Is it bad?
Right. That's right.
Is that I get the emails, trust me. I get emails too. But yeah. Right. What's your advice for responding specifically to Johns Hopkins secondary, and what is your secondary question?
Well, my specific advice is that they read your questions.
That's a good start.
And not give a trite answer to the question.
You don't want generic.
That's right.
Okay.
I'll give you two examples. One question has to do with adversity. Have they ever been in a position where they had to deal with adversity? Okay. Mm-hmm. And what was it? And tell us about it. And if they talk about someone else's medical condition as being, you know, part of their adversity, then they really haven't answered our question about their adversity, you see. So I really want them to reflect on what the question is asking.
Sure.
Another question is, you know, what type of medicine have they considered? And if they say, well, you know, I'm going to figure that out once I get to medical school, then I'm not sure if they've really given any thought to why they want to be in medical school. We're not going to hold them to what they write down, but we want them to talk about some experience that has led them to possibly choosing gynecology, obstetrics, or surgery. You know, what was it that really lit a fire under them? You see, and if they can't explain that, then I don't know what to think.
Right, and you shouldn't be expected to guess.
That's right. That's exactly right.
And that's why you asked the question.
Because we guessed incorrectly sometimes.
yeah. Okay.
Right.
What is a Johns Hopkins interview like?
Oh, you know, I do interviews, Linda,
okay.
And my colleagues who are outside my door sit to often tell me they can hear laughter in the interview room, and that's partly because I always try to find something to make the candidate relax and be at their absolute best. You know, we know that we're going to accept one-third of the people who come in for interviews, typically, not always, but, you know, eventually, and that's including the waiting list. And so to me, they've already cleared a hurdle that most applicants won't have the opportunity to clear. And so I want them to be at their absolute best. And so the typical interview will ask questions about how they may have come to medicine and, you know, what their influences were. And sometimes we may ask, you know, what are some of your concerns about being a doctor and where do you think you might come up short? And to me, there's no wrong answer.
Right.
I'm trying to get them to be thoughtful.
Okay.
And they're only about 30 minutes, 40 minutes. And we have two required interviews at Hopkins, and one is with a faculty member,
uh-huh.
and the other is with a medical student,
mm-hmm.
and they're both trained, and they're all members, and both are members of the admissions committee, and represent the students and their interview at the actual meeting. So we want them to get it right, meaning our members,
right,
get it right.
Are there activities for the interviewees on interview day?
Oh, yes, absolutely. When they come on interview day, they will either meet with me.
Mm-hmm.
Well, even before they meet with me, the evening before, we have what we call the greeters program, and mm-hmm. they are invited to meet with current first-year students who have no input in the process other than to, you know, meet with people who are in the same boat that they were in a year earlier in most cases. But these are always first-year students who they're meeting with, and it's just a relaxed environment. It's strictly off the record because we want the students to be themselves. And then the next day is interview day, and there's a optional tour of our housing facilities where many of our first-year students live, which are only two blocks from the campus, a block and a half. Actually, from this building, not from the campus, from this building.
Right.
And they come back there for a 45-minute presentation on admissions on their day and from the financial aid office. And I say presentation, but we don't use PowerPoint. It's a conversation. I give them an overview of the day, but also explain some of the things they may have questions about in terms of our joint degree programs, our study abroad opportunities here, opportunities for research and so forth. And the financial aid office explains our process and gives them information about our average indebtedness, so forth and so on. And then they're led down to a luncheon room where they have lunch with current faculty and medical students who have volunteered to meet with them. And again, this is off the record as well. And we want the students to relax, the candidates to relax. And then our medical students take them on a guided tour of the hospital, the education building, for about an hour after lunch, and bring them back here for their two interviews, which take place over a two-hour span, but they're maybe 40 minutes in the faculty interview and half an hour or so in the student interview. And then they're free to go, but usually not before 4:30, because we want our medical students who are also on the admissions committee but not interviewing that particular student have an opportunity to engage them in conversation.
Okay, great. Thank you. Now, I mentioned I'm getting calls at this time of year from students drowning in secondaries, but I'm also getting other kinds of calls and emails. And these are from medical school applicants who wonder, is it too late to apply? Maybe they had to retake the MCAT. Maybe events just happened that prevented them from applying earlier in the cycle. The question is, should I wait until next year and apply in June, or should I give it a shot now? How would you advise the competitive but not stellar applicant who hasn't yet submitted his or her MCAS application? Now, I know that your deadline for submission of the MCAS is October 15th, and again, this is probably going to go live the first week of October.
Right. You know, Linda, there are some medical schools that will tell you they have crunched the numbers, looked at the data, and it's best to apply as early as possible. We're not one of those schools.
Okay.
I tell people to apply when they're ready and when they're at their strongest. And for some individuals, that means they may have taken a later MCAT, meaning August or even early September, or they took courses over the summer, and they want those courses and, more importantly, in some cases, the grades on their transcript to show an upward trajectory. Mm-hmm. So I think it's really important that they apply when they're absolutely at their strongest, and for some that means waiting a little longer. There are plenty of applicants who get their application in June 1st to MCAS. Well, MCAS, we don't want the application unless it's been verified by MCAS, and that's usually not distributed to the schools that ask for verified applications until the last Friday in June. Mm-hmm. And then we will send our secondary to the verified MCAS submitters in early July.
Mm-hmm.
And so let's say they just took 2 or 3 days to turn it around, they still wouldn't get reviewed until later in July or beginning of August. Mm-hmm. So that, for us, there's really no advantage in that, you know, they're going to perhaps be reviewed earlier, but that doesn't necessarily mean an earlier interview. It may mean an earlier decision stating that they're not going to be admitted. And even then, we don't send out any notification until the middle of December.
Oh, right. So you really...
In terms of actions, final actions.
Right.
In other words...
So your class is really still open.
My class is wide open. We're still meeting as a committee in March.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You see.
All right.
So there's just... You know, there is a common myth that the earlier the better, but that may be common, but it doesn't necessarily apply to every medical school out there.
Right. Because, I mean, I've talked to many admissions directors, and they have said different things about their school. Clearly, Johns Hopkins has a different approach, and it's good to know that. So, you know, thank you.
And it's been like that for years, by the way. I mean, yeah, with the exception of the years when I was in Minnesota, I can tell you, even going back 15 years ago, it was the same year.
Okay, good. Thank you. Now, what advice do you have for medical school reapplicants? Whatever time in the cycle they applied, they didn't get in.
I think if they're going to be a reapplicant, depending on where they apply, I mean, if I'm speaking strictly for Hopkins, we don't provide feedback to people who are not accepted. There are just too many people in the process.
Right.
But some medical schools certainly may welcome emails or letters asking for feedback. But again, we're not one of those schools. But having said that, the most important thing I can tell them is to look at their profile, look at where the gaps may have been in terms of the institutions where they applied. You know, there are some people who are throwing what they call in football Hail Mary and hopes that someone will catch it, when in fact no one's going to catch it if they're that weak, you see. And if they need to take some time to improve their profile in some way, whether that's academic or clinically or in terms of research, they should take that time. And some of that can often mean taking a year before reapplying, particularly if you're talking about improving your academic profile. If you do a academic enhancement post-bac, that may be a 1 or 2 year program. If they need more clinical experience, and the only way they can write about it knowledgeably is if they spent half a year to a year in that experience, mm-hmm. rather than applying in the same year, calendar year, where they were rejected, and yet there's no change in their application.
Right. The definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over,
exactly.
Right?
That's exactly right.
And expecting a different result. Yeah, I'm going through this with a family member right now.
And look, also, I have seen people who've applied 7, 8, 9 times.
Wow.
With no difference in the application.
Do you remember Harold Stassen?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I always think of him when I hear stories of applicants who do not change anything, but just apply over and over and over,
over
and over
again.
Well,
we actually have a woman who's applied here at least 10 or 12 times.
Wow, that's something.
And we just wonder what's going on in her life that she has to keep applying to Hopkins.
And also, I mean, why has she hasn't changed something?
That's right, right. Well,
yeah, so
the good thing is that the MCAT at some point expired for us, so she did have to retake the MCAT, you know.
Right, okay.
But those were the only changes.
Okay. And on a forward-looking note, what advice would you give to med school applicants thinking ahead to applying in, you know, summer 2017?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, they should probably do some reflection now about what may be the possible gaps in their future application. For instance, I see emails from individuals who ask about what it is that will make them competitive for admission, and then they explain that, well, I haven't had much clinical experience, I really want to be a doctor. Well, then get more clinical experience, because I can almost tell them what the issue is going to be come next year. Or if someone says, well, I have, and I see these emails, believe it or not, they write to our secondary account, and then I often check those emails. I have a 3.0 on the in my institution, but I know I can do the work. And you can do the work, but there are people with 3.6s, 3.7s, 3.8s, 3.9s.
Show me.
Exactly. And, you know, luckily for us, but not for them, we have far more applicants than we have slots.
Right.
So, of course, we're going to, you know, and those people with 3.8s and 3.9s are just as passionate about being a physician. Why not give those folks the opportunity?
Because they have shown.
So I think that they have shown, exactly. So I think they really need to do an honest self-assessment before they actually apply to medical school. And that can start not junior year, even sophomore year. And, you know, going onto the website, looking at the MSAR, which you yourself have done, mm-hmm. what is it the school seems to say that they want to see in a strong applicant for admission? And in many cases, it isn't just, in most cases, it's not just grades and scores. We want people who will understand what it's, that it involves working with patients. And if you're a medical student and you are working with patients, well, you have to have some familiarity with that before you even get to medical school.
Okay, that's pretty clear. Paul, I think we're almost out of time. This has been incredibly insightful. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Linda. I've enjoyed talking with you, and I hope this is helpful.
It sure is. Where can listeners learn more about Johns Hopkins School of Medicine?
www.hopkinsmedicine.org/SOM/admissions.
Great. Okay. We'll definitely include that in our show notes at accepted.com/174. Listener, thank you so much for joining us for this, the 174th episode of Admission Straight Talk. If you found the show helpful, can I ask a favor? Could you leave your feedback on iTunes? It helps us get ranked more highly if there are more reviews, especially if they are 5-star reviews. We have links at accepted.com/174 to our iTunes page where it is super easy to leave that review. And again, you'll also find links to Johns Hopkins admissions site as well as some other resources we have for you. This is Admission Straight Talk, produced by Accepted, and I'm your host, Linda Abraham. I'll talk to you again next week.
Our theme music is provided by podcastthemes.com.